Now, if you remember, the three core areas we were looking at last week, or the basic kind of network of relationships we were exploring, were between literature, history, and space, or literature, history, and geography, if you want to put it that way. And we were doing this via Sam Selvan's novel, Lonely Londoners, which we like, don't like, love, hate. What's the consensus? Sorry, hate? Let's have a show of hands for hate. No haters. How many people loved Lonely Londoners? Fair few sprinkling of hands, very good. How many of you kind of liked it? It was okay. Okay, just you sort that out in your seminars, right? But what we were looking at in Lonely Londoners was an exploration, a literary exploration, of a particular historical moment in a particular environment, a city. And we were trying to really look at how the idea of belonging to a particular time and a particular place can be represented via the literary medium. So that was the kind of... the main points, checkpoints in our conversation last week. Now, what we're going to do this week is going to take one of the because we were thinking and talking about in ways in which people belong to time and space. Over the next 3 weeks, including this one, we're going to take three routes or three avenues in that formation of a sense of belonging. Today we're going to talk about work or labor. Next week we're going to talk about consumption or purchasing or buying. And the week after, the final week of your unit, of this particular unit, we're going to talk about what you might call habitation or inhabitation. So those are the three routes we'll take, starting with this idea of work today. And we're going to primarily do that by looking at Raymond Williams's ideas and filtering them through or running them through Sam Selvan's novel that most of you will have read by now. So let's start with a 3-minute film clip. I'll just try and... Okay. Hang on. I'm going to stop that because I can't get the volume up. You'll be wearily familiar with the song.
Third day of writing, a chap was seen on man, the young black kid, Luke McGarvey, walked down these steps, and the reason the question walked out into a mob, 500 or 600 people up there, they were bloody huge. It's anybody out there. And they chased him. Here we are in that band present in our Hill Gate, and this is the green door, as opposed to Hugh Grant's blue door, which is over there. Anyway, this is Total Man, also known as the Fortress. On the last night of the riots in 1958, the Teddy Boys were going around the area, and they knew something was up, because they couldn't see many black people on the street. And of course, they came around here, and they just, because this was a stronghold for black people in the area, they decided to torture it. But little did they know, there were 300 men here, some of whom had been recruited from Brixton, Jamaican men. Suddenly, all the windows opened, and bottles and bottled up cocktails and anything they could find up there was rained down on the Teddy Boys. Then the doors burst open, and there was a huge free for all in this meeting, right in front of us, which was the culmination of that, right, when the old Bill came in and nicked everyone.
So, how many of you have been to Notting Hill Carnival? Okay, fair few, very good. Now, one of the things I think it's interesting about Selvan's novel is although that was, by the way, Notting Hill riots, Notting Hill Gate riots, 1958, around the period that Selvan's covering. One of the things Selvan urges us to do in the novel is, although we have settled ideas of race as a category, and although the history of race as a kind of concept is very young, it's relatively young, it's about, let's say, about 150, 200 years old, and of course has very little or no scientific or empirical basis to it, it really is a kind of persistent and powerful in some ways sense of belonging. Now, although Selvan writing as a Caribbean writer and in some ways writing about the changing face of London, he's urging us in some ways to go beyond or think beyond race as a category of belonging. So one of the things we're going to try and do over these 3 weeks is to see how, without discounting this idea of race, you could see how we bring in other concepts, such as labor, such as consumption, such as habitation, into our examination of what it is, as one of the Selvan characters questions, and this will be on your handout, what it is that makes people belong, feel like they belong to a particular place in a particular time. Now, as I said, the first of those categories, and the novel urges us to look at these categories in some details while not bypassing the issue of race, is that of labor. Now, today let's start by talking about this idea of belonging to a historical space in a historical time by looking at Raymond Williams. Williams, the extract you will have read, is from a much larger work called, The Country and the City. And Williams, in many ways, is exploring the same issues that Selvan is interested in, ideas of belonging and ideas that change over time about particular spaces, such as the city and such as the country. Now, the first point, so let's try and break down Williams' thought and see how they fit around the same kind of problematics that Selvan is dealing with. So the first key point about Williams is this idea of a particular kind of association, intellectual, emotional, etc., that human beings develop on the kinds of settlement, on the kinds of physical settings they find themselves in. And he takes the city as an example of this. So the first quote on your handout: in the long history of human settlements, this connection between this land from which directly and indirectly we all get our living and the achievements of human society has been deeply known. And one of these achievements has been the city, the capital, the large town, a distinctive form of civilization. That, those are the key words there. A distinctive form of civilization that seems to attach to the idea of a world city. For example, when we talk about London, we usually talk about a world city, right? Now, that means, that's a slightly kind of lazy description. It means many things. But a connotation of a particular kind of expansiveness, a connotation, particular kind of possibilities, even though most of you who live in London or have lived in London or know people who live in London will know that people who actually live in London don't, you know, don't have time or the energy to take, avail themselves of any of the, you know, humongous amounts of opportunities and possibilities that surround them. Anyway, they're usually too stressed. They're trying to get to work and get back to bed safely. So, but nonetheless, the idea of being surrounded by possibilities is a real draw for human beings and their ideas of belonging. So, as I was saying, one of the characters, one of Selvan's characters, precisely asks exactly this question: what it is that a city have, we looked at this briefly last week, that any place in the world have that you get so much to like it, you wouldn't leave it for anywhere else. Why it is that although they grumble about it all the time, again, a familiar London attribute, curse the people, curse the government, say all kinds of things about this and that, why it is that in the end, everyone cagey about saying outright that if the chance come, they will go back to them green islands in the sun. So this is, of course, has a Caribbean context to this, but think this applies, it seems to me, exactly to all inhabitants of a particular city in a particular time. There, on the one hand, you have this sense of achievement and possibilities that surround you, the excitement, the buzz. On the other hand, you're torn between this constant longing to get away somewhere calmer, somewhere safer, somewhere where time operates in a slightly different velocity. Might be a green island in the sun, might be a rural corner in Wiltshire, might be somewhere else, I don't know. Somewhere away from the city. Those are the contrary pulls that shape your attachment or your formation of your belonging to a particular space in any particular time. The question, though, is what is it that keeps you there? You're complaining about the tube, you're complaining about, I don't know, the latest tax rise, you're complaining about shit coffee, whatever it might be. You know, what keeps you there? That is what Selvan's characters are inquiring. So you have the first idea that you have to juggle with when it comes to Williams is this settled idea of possibilities, but also a set of vanishing possibilities that human beings associate with forms of settlement, such as a grand capital city, but any form of settlement as such. So you have this contradictory pull between your sense of belonging to a particular space and a sense that that urges you to leave. We were speaking briefly about modernity and the kind of constant peripatetic condition that we call the modern, this kind of footlooseness, I guess, this urge to move. So in a city, I suppose what Williams is trying to gesture to us is a city is a space of contradictory forms of emotion and belonging. So that's the first thing, a long-settled idea of what a city is, what the countryside is. What, in other words, different physical spaces mean to people differently over time and space. Now, remember that question, what it is that makes you belong to a particular point in time in a particular space. Williams then goes on to question this is the second point about Williams. On the one hand, he concedes that we have powerful associations with associated with powerful, long-established associations, powerfully associated with certain spaces. The second point to remember about Williams is his second critical move is to upset, not upset, to unsettle this sense of powerful associations. How does he do that? This is your third quote on the handout. Yet the real history, so on the one hand you have these lived emotions, this sense of belonging and unbelonging, but what he calls the real history, throughout has been astonishingly varied. That is to say, the history of these spaces, the country, the city, they have been astonishingly varied. Why? And this, the next few lines are significant because notice how Williams differentiates, or the categories, or the criteria for Williams's differentiation. What does he say? The country way of life has included the very different practices of hunters, pastoralists, farmers, and factory farmers. The city, no less, has been of many kinds: state capital, administrative base, religious center, market town, port, mercantile depot, military barracks, industrial concentration. Note the categories that he brings out for differentiating these spaces. What are the categories? They're different kinds of labor: factory, farmer, pastoralist, etc. for the country, state capital, administrative base, religious center, market town, port, etc. for the city. For Williams, what he's calling real history of these spaces can be organized alongside the axis, or along the axis of what people actually do, how people work in these spaces. Okay? So on the one hand, you have these powerful emotional associations built up around conventional ideas about city, area of possibility, areas of unsettlement, etc. On the other hand, you have the real objective history whereby out of which the kind of historical ferment of activities out of which these associations are formed, okay? And that, for Williams, has to do with these various modes of labor, as we might choose to call it. Now, Selvin, very cannily, is already clued into this. One of the things that you'll find in the novel is the contest over the meaning of work. The meaning of work, and by work, I don't just mean employment and jobs, but actually what people do with each other, the kind of labor that they perform over throughout the course of the day. It might be like Tanti going shopping, for example, which we'll come back to. So this is an early snippet from the novel about one of the first formative experiences of Sir Galahad when he's arrived in town, and Moses, his newfound friend. The first experience that Galahad has of London, where is it? In what we might now call the job center, right? The employment exchange, as it was known then. And here's what the passage is, and it's worth reading carefully. Moses take him around the block to the next building. When they enter, a kind of atmosphere hit Galahad hard so that he had to stand up against the wall for a minute. It's a real physical experience. He walks in and he feels it slammed into this network of people's feelings and experiences that literally leaves him breathless. He has to lean against the wall for a while. It ain't have no place in the world that exactly like a place where a lot of men get together to look for work and draw money from the welfare state while they ain't working. Is a kind of place where everyone is your enemy and your friend. So this is one of the first formative experiences of Galahad. He's gone into this employment exchange, job center, and what has struck him is both the fact that men there are, of course, looking for work, some of them looking for benefits, but the sense that you're both everyone's friends, i.e. you're all in it together, but you're also competing against everyone. They're also your enemies. So one of the first things that Galahad, one of the first lessons that Galahad learns in a city are the possibilities of solidarity, the feeling of friendship, that you share not only a certain kind of space, but a certain mode of living, i.e. work. So you have a sense of solidarity, of being in it together, but also simultaneously, there's a paradoxical and contradictory pull in the other direction. You're in this work environment together, but you're competing against each other, right? There are a finite amount of jobs. You're all queuing for it. Some of you will get it, others will won't. And it's a kind of extraordinary evocation of a first impression of a new home, which London is for Galahad, and that early lesson in what the dominant mode of the city is, right? All that sense of possibilities, the sense of excitement, at the base of that lies this idea of competitive work, okay? Competitive labor that also has forms of solidarity built into it. If you've ever, have you, okay, you don't have to kind of, you know, come up with confessions, but have you ever queued in a job center? Not yet. It's coming, right? So what you're going to find there is precisely this possibility. Or let's say, forget about job center. If you've queued anywhere, right? You're trying to get somewhere fast. There's this long queue. You're all kind of, you know, queuing up to buy a finite amount of tickets or something. You all have this sense of, okay, this is a queue, we're all in it together, but, you know, the bastard in front of me might get it first, right? So you have this sense of constant paradoxical belonging and unbelonging at the same time. This mode of competition that cities, especially by the dint of their volume, the size of work available, etc., seem to specialize in. That's the first formative experience of Sir Galahad. Remember, he comes from a very sleepy, kind of much more gentler, not gentler, much more slower, a space with a different kind of temporality. And he's adjusting both to the physical difference in London, but also a different kind of time scale in London. Things are operating at a speeded up, and a speeded up version of life, of what he's used to. Now, this concentration on a mode of being via work, i.e. the sense of who you are, depending on what kind of work you do and what are your relationship with your fellow workers. You're all, obviously, you know, you'll know this simply by the dint of belonging to the university, your students, friends, etc., but you're also engaged in a particular form of labor, although it may not seem so, right, at the moment. And you're engaged in a particular form of both solidarity and competition with each other, right? So you book a study space in the library. You got a seminar coming up. You're all sharing your, you know, you pool your expertise together. But somewhere in the back of your head, going, I'm going to hold back something for the seminar because I really want to show how clever I am over my close and dear friend, right? So that's the kind of work you're engaged in. The kind of it's kind of built in. It's a kind of inbuilt mode of belonging. You're of course very close friends, and I'm sure you'd kind of, you know, give up your time and lives for each other, but you're also competing against each other. Okay, so that in some ways lies at the very core of your being, and that's what Selvon is exploring, and in a way Williams is exploring. This is how your sense of belonging to a space is formed, by what you do, by what kind of labor you command. Now this category of labor becomes a kind of central one for the new migrants of the 1950s, and indeed migrants and inhabitants everywhere. So this is the sociological study done in the 50s and 60s, an excerpt from which is at the bottom of the first page of your handout. Upon arrival, these are West Indian men and women arriving, less than a quarter of the West Indian men polled by the sociologist Ruth Glass considered themselves to be semi or unskilled. Yet over, remember what Galahad says when he arrives, that he's an electrician, he works with electrics, right? So he's a kind of skilled worker. And that's the kind of majority of the Caribbean men and women are coming to Britain, or certainly men coming, and we'll come into the implications of that, the different kinds of labor that move around the different axes of gender. Certainly the men polled in the 50s and 60s saw themselves as skilled workers. Yet over three-fifths of the men were placed in such jobs in Britain, with fully half of them, that is to say semi or unskilled jobs in Britain, with fully half of them consigned to the lowest category. Men who were employers in Port of Spain, Trinidad, became factory hands in London. So, and this is, Selvan is very aware of this being one of the formative categories of the new migrant Caribbean experiences in the 50s. A number of characters in the novel, for example, Galahad and Moses' conversations revolve around getting the right kind of work. Because what you see in the process of the novel, what you see unraveling is a casualization of specialist labor, right? So these guys work as electricians or whatever they might be, their specialism might be in the Caribbeans, but they no longer can access the same kind of work in Britain. They're moving, they're doing manual labor, they're doing bricklaying, they're working in railway sheds, et cetera, moving heavy, doing heavy manual work that no one else is doing. So what you have, and that really throws them. They think, hang on, this is not what we do. This is not what we do for a living. This means not only revising or learning new skills, but also revising an idea of who we are. They're tussling with the idea of, this is what we used to do in the Caribbeans. This is what we do now. So their whole idea of who they are, and notice the emotional trajectories of the characters that fluctuate according to not only whether they get work or not, but what kind of work they're doing. Because that determines their relationship with each other, but also with their co-workers. So a lot of what happens in the 50s and 60s, we'll go back, we'll kind of look at the historical context of this a little bit probably next week when we talk about consumption. What is happening is a casualization of specialist labor. And that is not just dry economic terms. That means that how you see yourself and how you see others around you, those emotions change. Also, what you see yourself to be doing, how you see yourself to be living in a particular space changes. And these characters are wrestling with this whole new gamut of emotions. So what you have here are new forms of solidarity, but also new forms of emotional unmooring. All these people who have arrived have now, in some ways, have to relearn who they are and what their friendship groups, etc., what we now call peer groups, etc., what those are, because the way they work, the way they live, the kind of work that does has changed. So, for example, you saw the Notting Hill riots there, and in a very and that's a very conventional kind of narrative of Notting Hill riots, in the sense that they talk about Notting Hill being an ex-working class area, quite rightly, and the new migrants, the new immigrants coming in and triggering of these tensions about, as he put it, will they take their our homes? Will they take will they take our birds? Will they take our way of life, or whatever way they put it? So it becomes, Notting Hill riots in 58 becomes conventionally understood as working class competition between new migrants and older settled an older settled class who are facing challenge from these new migrants in an environment of austerity, right? 1950s Britain, remember? If you read David Kingston's novel, Mammoth Historical Project, 1950s Britain is bracketed as austerity Britain, right? So much like 2010s, of course, austerity 2010s. So the sense of scarce or dwindling resources being competed, or the competition that generates between more settled groups of people and new migrants or new arrivals. That's the conventional reading of Notting Hill riots. But note what Selvan also says in the novel. It have a kind of communal feeling with the working class and the spades. This is on the flip side of your handout. Because when you're poor, things does level out. It don't have much up and down. Sure, austerity Britain sees tension between new migrants and older groups of workers and social classes, but there are also new possibilities of solidarity. All the interaction between the older, predominantly white working class characters in the novel, in that area, and the new migrants, men and women, all those relationships are simultaneously marked by tension and a feeling of solidarity, because the feeling is you're all in this together, the kind of communal feeling. Because when you're poor, things does level out. It don't have much up and down. So what you get here are new forms of labor forming around a particular kind of space, the city, at a particular time. You're going into, and Jameson will talk about this much more in much more details next week. What we're going into is from what you might conventionally call a Fordist economy that had held sway in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and the post-Fordist economy, what we now call flexible accumulation or globalization, a globalized economy. That's the cusp, 1950s and 60s, London and Britain, that's the cusp of the transition. And what these people are doing are being forced to find new forms of labor, new forms of belonging, and new forms of emotional networks between each other. This is marked by tension, obviously, and competition, but also forms of belonging and solidarity. They're finding new ways of really forging friendships. That, Selvin is suggesting, is one of the answers to the question that his characters raise. What is it that makes you stay in a new city? Clearly, you have hostility, as in the riots, but you also have, when we talk about the possibilities in a new city or a new space, we are not just talking about, I don't know, glamorous nightclubs or cafes or bars or new jobs you could get. You're also talking about new kinds of friendships that you might forge. And what Selvin is suggesting is this new kinds of, and what William suggests, is this new kinds of friendships are possible along the axes of different kinds of labor that you engage in. Okay, so that's the second point, that the ideas, these ideas of what a city is, what a country is, what any space is, change over time, and they change depending on the kind of work and labor that human beings engage in. The third point, in a way, that follows from this point is if they change, of course, the third point about Williams's thesis is the permanence of change, transitions. Permanence of change not only in the physical fabric of a city, but also the permanence of change in how and human emotions about these settled spaces. So, as he says, this is on your handout as well, these were the altering communication. Williams is particularly interested in the fact that how quickly and how historically our settled ideas of the city and country and, you know, all the in-between spaces, how they're determined, although we keep thinking that a city is timeless in certain ways or a country is timeless in other ways, we keep thinking those things. The reality is such a flux and how quickly that transforms over time. There were the altering communications, the altering connections, communications, connections being key Williamsian terms, between country and city and between all the intermediate places and communities, the suburbs, for example. The intermediate or temporary jobs and settlements, casualized labor, non-casualized labor. So this country life had its meanings, but these changed in themselves and changed in relation to others. I suppose what Williams's thesis is despite what we feel about these spaces, we're constantly in a flux about how these relationships and these spaces themselves change. There's a kind of interesting paradox here. We think country life, for example, is timeless, but we live, when we live in the countryside or in the suburbs, the intermediate places, we live in a flux and live in a constancy of change. So the curious question is this: why, when we embody change, when we live change every day of our lives, why do we persist in thinking that space X is timeless or changeless? What is it that determines that kind of difference in our emotional and mental makeup, what Williams would call an ideological makeup, and your lived experience? And that's where literature enters into Williams's category, right? We'll come to that in a bit. But the third point you should make, take note of, is the permanence of change between in the physical fabrics of the place. Of course, London in 1950s, as this guy was saying, Notting Hill feels very different, and that's true for all the spaces that you will have encountered in your lives. So there's that permanence of change, but what also changes is the way people interact and adjust to that space. So let me give you a splendid example from the novel, the character of Tanti, right? Now this is a woman who comes from the Caribbean, as I said, from a different time and space, literally. And she's brought up children all her life, and is now Tanti, the auntie of the family. And that is a kind of, what Selvin is very careful to sketch that out, is that too is a kind of specialized labor. It's not a kind of labor that's recognized as such quite often. It's not a kind of labor that's rewarded as such quite often. But that too is a very powerful mode of being. And the character of Tanti, how she makes her own niche in London, is a very interesting move that you should look out for. Why? Because here is a woman who's changing, forging new kind of relationships with a new kind of space, very quickly, very flamboyantly, but with what seems to be fairly unrecognized way of working, i.e. supporting, bringing up children, working in the family, etc. Look at what Tanti does. She revolutionizes the shopping habits of a whole community, right, in a street. This is what she does. All poor Lewis business talk out in that shop with Tanti Big Mouth. For it ain't have no woman like stand up and talk to other people business like Tanti. And didn't take she long to make friends and enemy with everyone in the district. It was Tanti who caused the shopkeeper to give people credit. You remember that episode where she walks into the shop and she says, you know, very, very nice shop, very nice shop. Why don't you give credit? And the guy says, look, you know, you pay the money, you take your goods, that's it. And she keeps at him for the next, not nagging, but saying, you know, it'll be really nice. Where I come from, we always get credit, and everyone pays on time, blah, blah, blah. Till the shopkeeper says, okay, fine, you can have credit, but just you. And she goes, why just me? You know, there are other people as well. What she's doing, and by the end, of course, the shopkeeper says, okay, fine, you can have your credit. Come Friday, everyone gets their pay, they come. They buy stuff on credit beforehand, and they pay him back, etc. What you're having is a total transformation in the relationship between a community and the shopkeeper, not via one of the settled old members of the community, because they got used to how labor is rewarded, how what you can buy and sell for your efforts, but by this old woman who comes from the Caribbean and changes the whole, not just the space, but the way people behave. So what I guess Williams is flagging up there, and Selvin is flagging up there, are set. People operate with settled ideas of who we are, how do we live in a particular society, what is permitted to us in that particular society, how we can behave with each other. But we also operate as active agents. We change. We are agents who are capable of collective and singular change. And we can implement change, like Tanti, not necessarily via riots only, but remember the bloke says at the end, what the three things we got, the first thing he says are the Notting Hill Carnival. The way people behave has changed drastically, of course, from the riots to the carnival, but also in little things, like change, like convincing the local shopkeeper that credit is a good thing. Credit, after all, is dependent on a form of trust. You'll pay me a week later. And I trust you to do that because you're local, you come here all the time, etc. That recognition comes via Tanti in the shop, a newcomer. So Selvin, Williams via Selvin, the way we can read this is how people bring with them their old settled ideas, or keep with them the old settled ideas of living, but they're also capable of changing depending on what they make of their own labor. Tanti, remember, a lot of the times in the novel, she's really angry with her other Caribbean nephews and nieces. She says, you know, you don't respect me anymore. I can't do anything here. All of you are going out to work. I'm just an old. And this is what she's been told. She's been told, you're a bit of a burden. You know, you shouldn't have come. And that's quite a kind of, powerful thing to be told. She does not give in. She doesn't stop there. She goes out to the streets. She talks to a shopkeeper. She effects small, but in a kind of that way, revolutionary change in the life of a community. So the third point you're keeping in mind is the constancy and permanence of change that can go either way, in the way of Tanti, take a more a positive communal form. But change can also be negative, and you can see the hostile reaction and to that change in the riot. So there's nothing, per se, change is not good or bad. It's a historical permanence. It's what human beings make of it, individually and collectively, that determines the vector of that change. So that's the third thing in mind. Third thing of Williams. We've got 10 minutes. We'll probably have one more point, and I'll leave the point about consumption for next week. The final kind of point and a half, I guess I'll try and crunch it a little bit, is where does literature or culture enter this historical process? Because that's really our key investigation, the relationship between literature, environment, and history. Remember, that's how we started the unit. In these changes, in these transformations, internal and external, where does culture fit in? Where does literature fit in? For Williams and for Selvin, culture is not necessarily something that falls out of a book when you open it, right? Or something that is beamed at you in the cinema hall or from your iPod headphones. Culture is a lived way of life. That's the key for Williams. Culture is what you do, the kind of labor that you perform. Now, and since the relation of the country and the city is not only an objective problem, i.e. a theoretical problem, and history, but has been and still is for many millions of people a direct and intense preoccupation and experience. In other words, you feel it in your body. It's not something you learn from textbooks, although textbooks are a part of it. Culture is written on your body in the way you behave, what you buy, what you read, how you talk, etc. In other words, it's a much wider system. It's a system, it's a field of networks where every element is networked to the other. The relations are not only of ideas and experience, i.e. when you're talking culture, you're not just sitting in a library and saying, oh, that film, wasn't that so cool? That's a part of a cultural exchange, but that doesn't arise out of this splendid ether of ideas or an idealized realm. It arises out of an embodied feeling of having lived in a certain kind of way. But of rent and interest, of situation and power, a wider system. And this can be really powerful. This can be really enabling and ennobling. Remember the dance hall scene of Tanti, and this is what Tanti says, taking a firm hold of Harris. Remember, Harris is a little bit embarrassed that Tanti is there, and he's going, actually, I want to dance with this beautiful girl. Tanti is having none of it, right? She goes, this is towards the end of the book when they go to this big party, right? For it ain't have no, she goes, tell this girl to unlace you. Right, so she looks at Harris dancing with this very attractive woman. She says, tell this girl to unlace you. You know what they're playing? Fan me, Saga boy, fan me. And that is my favorite calypso. These English girls don't know how to dance calypso, man. Lady, excuse him. So what you have here is that, Harris is really pissed off. He's going, there goes my chance for the evening, right? I've got to dance with Tanti now. But what you have here is a really strong statement of cultural belonging. Tanti is saying, this is a new environment. This is a new, and this is a kind of, both spatially and emotionally, this is new for me. But this is a snatch of song from home. This is a part of my being. Fan me, Saga boy, fan me, right? I don't know what that means. I don't know what tune that is. Maybe someone can tell me. But there, her claim is paramount. Unlace Harris, she says. He is my boy now. We come from a particular context at a particular time. We are going to dance, right? And nobody is going to stand in our way. Now, what is happening here is an insertion or the declaration of a kind of cultural belonging in a new environment of which it becomes a part. So what you're having here is a calypso dance in the 1950s, a woman's strong, perhaps nostalgic association with it, but an assertion of a very fabric of her being. Okay, she's saying, this dance is mine, not necessarily because she thinks Harris is a particularly good thing, because the calypso is. And that is coded onto my body. So it's a simultaneously an act of nostalgia for what she's left behind, but also an assertion of belonging to this new space. This is in London. These new clubs that are springing up, the dance halls, the calypso music that's coming up, this is becoming, via Tanti, via all the characters, a part of the fabric of London itself. In time, let's say 50 years from now, it'll be impossible, literally, those of you are familiar with the contemporary popular music scene, not to hear, not to pick up strains of what used to be called Afro-Caribbean music in contemporary British music, anywhere in popular music. So whether you're into dubstep or dancehall or whatever you listen to, or grime or whatever you're dancing to at the moment, what you now call urban British music has footprints of the original calypso rhythm coded genetically into it. How does that happen? Because when Tanti is saying it's very much a part of the Caribbean, she's saying this is home for me. I'm going to dance a home tune. As she's doing so, so this is why I say labor is not just economic, it's also performative. As she is dancing, calypso becomes a part of London. Calypso becomes a part of England. To the extent now that we cannot move without hearing that snatch of song from the 1950s. So what you're having here is culture transformed from one context to another, but also transforming that very context. It transforms Britain in a positive way, in what you might call a communal way, even as it becomes an act of nostalgia for Tanti in the 50s. So that's what Williams means when he says culture is a lived experience. It's not something fossilized. It's not something you leave behind. It's not something you say, calypso belongs to X, you know, or Rai belongs to Algeria, or, you know, all those musical styles are moored to a geographical space. It doesn't work that way. Culture transforms and is transforming because it's performative. Whether you get paid for it or not, that's immaterial. Because of the way, if you break it down, because it is embodied, because of the way you move your body, it becomes a part of a new environment. Okay? And that can never be genetically written out, whether it's, you know, or operated out of this new environment, whether you have riots or whether you have, you know, sort of racism or whatever it is, that bit of culture becomes a lived part of the flesh of New London. And that's how a city constantly generates and regenerates itself. So the question I'll leave you with this, as I said, I'll try and finish 5 minutes early, leave you with this for next week is, if that is so, if culture is transforming and transformative, okay, what happens to you as cultural critics? That's what you are, in case you didn't know by now, right? You are cultural and literary critics, right? What happens to your perspective? How do you deal with this fact of constantly transforming culture in a constantly transforming space? What is your hook? How do you read it? Right? That's the final, that's the essence of the final point of Williams on your handout. What is your perspective? How do you treat, because every literary and cultural work will have an angle, how do you read that angle? And that's a question we'll take up via Jameson next week. Right, off you go and become cultural critics in your own right.